Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. So good evening. I hope you're well. We were trying to get our cameras to show you our bird feeder. I don't know if you saw the bird feeder. We have a lot of fun here. So here the temperature was -1 when I woke up at 4. Now it's 8 o'clock and it's down to -4. So the temperature's falling. The snow melted a bit yesterday. Now it's frozen, so it's very crunchy. And the birds are happy at the bird feeder. And it's a good time to meditate. Yesterday, I was talking about happiness as a method, which is a kind of interesting way to look at it. And if you consider the teachings of the Buddha, is the genius of it is that he recommends to us a lifestyle which does bring a lifestyle based on goodness, sila, dana, responsibility, being sensitive to each other, practicing metta bhavana, which really brings up a lot of good, wholesome sense of happiness in the mind. But then the spiritual practice is not so much to become happy as we are encouraged in a kind of consumer society, not to become happy, but actually the spiritual exercise is to look at dukkha, to look at discontent, to regard suffering and understand it, which is, if you think about it, it's a quite an interesting combination. So he presents the best way you could do this is by being a good person. But being a good person is not sufficient. Sila and dana would not be sufficient, but they're necessary. And having that as the basis, then life will still bring discontent. Life will still have problems. You know, the body will get sick. Families will have arguments. Societies will have problems. The environment will be problematic. That's the nature of the whole business. And so then the spiritual exercise within this goodness is going right to the feeling of discontent. And why that's important is because the feeling of discontent brings forth tanha. And tanha is the search for some kind of objective experience which compensates for the dukkha, gets rid of the dukkha, distracts me from the dukkha, gets me away from the dukkha. And so the mind goes out searching for objects, for experiences, for emotions, which get me away from the dukkha. The problem with, and we'll all do that to a certain extent, the problem with that is it's going in the wrong direction if you're seeking the unconditioned. If you're looking for what the Buddha realized, and he said we could realize, because the unconditioned must always be here and now. You hear this teaching again and again and again, right, around the Four Noble Truths. But it's important to remember that the methodology, say, is not to be miserable all the time, not to make yourself suffer, do as best as you can in a life of goodness. And then when discontent arises, you've got the equipment to bear witness to unfulfilled craving. And as you do that, as the craving ceases, you notice more and more and more and more the beauty of inner silence, and that becomes a magnet that you go towards, not because you're seeking it from desire, because you're noticing something, you're noticing the peace of the mind. So there's a piece that I often read on retreats, and I think most of you have heard this, but I find it very, very helpful as a reflection on that theme. So this is from a teacher called John Klein. He uses the word objects in the sense, not just material objects like trees or cars or things like that, but also any emotion, any thought, any feeling is an object in awareness, as I've been teaching. So that's the way he's using the word objects here. So this is quite pithy, so bear with me. We must therefore begin with the analysis of desire. What do I want? Can my desire be gratified by the possession of objects? Objects, are they what I seek? So that's not just a car or food, it's emotional, physical, whatever, all things in this sense, all objects. Objects, are they what I seek? Do they contain what I seek? Let us observe what happens when a desire is satisfied. We see that the gratification of a desire is nothing but its death, and that therefore, when we are in search of bliss, we really are pursuing nothing but the death of desire. And that's another way of talking about nirodha, cessation, the cessation of desire, the death of desire. And that's what the Buddha is saying, that the unconditioned or the deepest peace of the heart is realized through the cessation of desire. This proves that our ultimate desire is non-desire. It's a paradox. Our ultimate desire is non-desire, because when we function from desire, we're trying to get something that puts an end to desire. This proves that our ultimate desire is non-desire. But non-desire appears to our normal consciousness as being blankness. And yet it is in this blankness that we must try to probe with open eyes so as to discover its true nature. So by blankness, it's just like tamada, the ordinariness of listening to sound. It doesn't seem like much. In fact, okay, so, and yet it is in this blankness that we must try to probe with open eyes so as to discover its true nature. In fact, this nothingness is experienced by everybody in infinitesimal gaps which occur between thoughts, each time one desire dies, giving place to the next. So this is, and many teachers teach this, this idea that when thought ceases, desire ceases, the sense of a person ceases. But it's so quick, it's so infinitesimal, it's so small, we don't notice it, and we jump into the next sense of ego or self or becoming or worrying or whatever. And so he's asking us to notice that gap. Many teachers do that. So last, your morning, your this morning, I suggested at the end of the meditation path, you know, you walk your 20 paces and you've been thinking, and then suddenly you notice the end of the path, say, and that's the gap. That's where the sense of ego or self or time, all these things end, and there's just the silence. And so he's asking us, really notice that, really pay attention to that. In fact, this nothingness is experienced by everybody in infinitesimal gaps which occur between thoughts, each time one desire dies, giving place to the next. If from time to time we experience moments of stillness and deep attention turned towards those gaps of nothingness, little by little, the emptiness will reveal itself as being full and finally as supreme plenitude. So in that gap, tanha is not operating yet. But when tanha arises, there's discontent, we seek an object. So he's saying, no, notice the gap before you try seeking something else, before you go anywhere else, and see if you can sustain. And that's the way I've been suggesting on this retreat, this sense of awakened consciousness, that's what it is. And then you kind of almost observing the awakened consciousness itself. I mean, it's hard to imagine that because usually observation implies an object. But here you're just attentive to the very sense of awakened consciousness, yeah? And encouraging that all the time. One should adopt this attitude as often and as clearly as possible, thereby allowing it to be more penetrating and effective. With this in view, one should be available, ceaselessly questioning oneself, calmly observing one's own behavior without passion. So, you know, I love that word availability. Now, availability isn't like you're getting something, it's you're available. And if I'm trying to get something or get rid of something, or I've just lost in my fantasies, then I'm not available. So it's an interesting word to bring into your practice. You know, you're walking in meditation. What should I do? Be available. I'm here. Okay. Benyang Niang. And that's a very, it doesn't sound like much, but it's hard to sustain that because of tanha. Because tanha is always looking for an objective experience. So do that paragraph again, okay? Because it's very dense, right? So it's good to think it through. If from time to time we experience moments of stillness and deep attention, turn towards these gaps of nothingness, little by little the emptiness will reveal itself as being full and finally as supreme plenitude. So notice, this isn't the function of tanha. It's not like the person is trying to get something. He's just noticing the silence between thoughts and kind of curious about the silence between thoughts. So it's not like you're looking for an experience. And this is the difficulty. Any kind of reading like this that talks about bliss or beauty, you start to look for bliss and beauty. And the very looking, the very tanha, is what the Buddha is saying we have to let go of. This will reveal itself as being full and finally a supreme plenitude. One should adopt this attitude as often and as clearly as possible, thereby allowing it to be more penetrating and effective. With this in view, one should be available, ceaselessly questioning oneself. Well, what does that mean? Well, to me, it means, how is it now? Rather than just an analytical thinking, it's like, how do I feel now? I feel like this. And a question, if you're not looking for an answer, a question, it really makes your mind attentive, right? What is it like? What is this moment like now? And then there's the silence. You could say it's a good moment, it's a bad moment, but before you define it, it's like this. What does it feel like? Huh? And that's what he means by constant questioning. It's not the questioning of why am I like this and I shouldn't be like that and why do I think that? That's ego thinking. This is, I would say, meditative awakening by using a question. What is it? How is it now? And then you wait. And that brings you to the silence. That brings you to the gap. A new and non-objective outlook may then progressively prevail on us. And we may come to understand that we are not the ego. So, you know, I was thinking this morning about personality. Personality is weird. None of, you know, like Lompa Cha, his personality was different than Lompa Liam's, is different than Lompa Samedo's, right? And so personality is, I think, like a vipaka kamma of some sort, genetic, karmic, whatever. And we all manifest in different ways, don't we? Like Yongpung is not the same as all his sisters, and Vipon is not the same as me, and so on and so forth, you know? And within that, certainly the expression of personality becomes more beautiful in that we let go of arrogance and fear and nastiness, you know, all of that. So it becomes a more beautiful expression. But it's, you know, if you ever just observe personality, isn't it weird how some you just it just manifests and does these things called Yongpeng or Yongvibun. And so what's interesting about personality is that you can observe it. You can observe a shy personality. You can observe a doubtful personality. It's possible to observe that. And when you observe it, then you no longer become it, and that's ego. So ego, from I think the way it's used in a Buddhist perspective, is just this believing in this personality thoughts that we have. I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, I shouldn't be this, I shouldn't be that. And believing in that. But actually, it's really curious. You can actually notice that. The way my personality will manifest at a meeting as opposed to Ajahn Bhavaro's or Venerable Khemakko's is different. How we interpret something and attaching to that, you attach to an object. So what he's suggesting, a new and non-objective outlook may then progressively prevail on us, and we may come to understand that we are not the ego. That personality comes, yeah, it's a part of just like Lompo Liam is still a personality in that sense. He doesn't change to be Lompo Samedo or Lompo Cha. I know a lot of us, when we, like I think Lompo Samedo, when he first was the Jawa at Wat Nanacha, you know, he tried to do things like Lompo Cha did, which didn't work because he's not Lompo Cha, right? He had his own personality and his own way of practice and his own way of talking and expression. And he tried to imitate that, right? But no, there is personality. But the thing is that curiously enough, awareness can know that. And you begin to see that your real identity is more the awareness rather than the personality. And yet the personality will function. It's like the breath will function until you die. The personality will function until you die. Huh? And I was pondering that this morning, how curious personalities are. But the beauty of this is you're not trying to become a different personality. You are trying to let go of greed, hatred, and delusion so that life is a much more pleasant and happy experience. But what you're seeing that your identity is not in these thinking personalities, but in the awareness itself. Yeah, that's my sense of it. So again, a new and non-objective outlook may then progressively prevail on us, and we may come to understand that we are not the ego, we're not the personality. We may then, with a complete and new awareness, taste the unexpected flavor of those moments of non-desire, which will be revealed as being full, silent, and peaceful. So when Like you think about, let's say something like disappointment. Let's say that you're a good friend to someone and you do service to them and you help them. And then in your time of need, they don't help you. So what that gives rise is disappointment. And so disappointment is a type of unsatisfactoriness. It's a type of negative feeling. Now, when you take refuge in personality, then you start to think, that's not fair. I've given so much to her. Now she doesn't support me. I'm never going to talk with her again. I hope she has a car crash. I hope, no, that's not so bad, I hope. But your mind, the sense of a person is created from the disappointment, paticca sammuppada, dependent origination. But then as you understand this witnessing consciousness, we say, well, that's not, disappointment isn't my real home. Thought isn't my real home. My real home is this knowing. And then you see, oh, disappointment feels this way. And that's the first noble truth. You take dukkha, and you stand under it, you understand it, that it feels like that. And that cuts the tendency to go to thought and to go into tanha. Tanha is what takes you into thought. Blame, anger, I'm never going to talk with her again, time, past, future. And then maybe the next day the memory comes up or she sends an email, how are you doing? And you want to send her a terrible email back. What do you mean, how am I doing? Where have you been? You haven't helped me, blah, 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 blah. That's rebirth. But when you get the email and you say, oh, disembodiment goes this way, if you stay with it, there's no rebirth of self, and there's a taste of silence within the dukkha. Silence within the disappointment. And that's hard to do. Most people won't do that. It's much easier to blame. Or much easier maybe than to have a whiskey or something. I don't know. So the profundity of the Buddha's teaching is taking that very thing we don't want, like disappointment, and say, stand under that. Notice how that is. Bear with it. And then tanha will cease. And in the cessation, you have nirodha, the death of desire. Now, if you follow the desire, okay, you say, no, I don't believe the monk. I'm going to send you a really nasty email, right? And something he says, don't do it. But anyway, you write the email, you send it, and then you have a fight. And then you feel regret. And then you feel remorse. And the whole messiness of samsara traps you into thought, into communication, and you've been reborn because of the desire. But the sending of that revengeful email felt good. I got her. That feels really good. And that's tanha's, that's Mara saying, if you give her a poke, you'll feel really, really good. So you give her a poke and then you feel regret. And then she writes to her, if this is an exaggeration. So it's tempting to follow tanha. It's much more difficult. It's a yoga, isn't it? It's the yoga of dukkha. It's like yoga is practices for liberation. That's what yoga means. It's not just hatha yoga. So you use the yoga of dukkha, of understanding dukkha, to see the cessation of desire. So in this case, each time that her memory would come up, you would have that feeling of disappointment, but you'd bear witness to it, and it would cease. And each time you'd be coming back to that gap, to that silence, to puru, to awareness. So that's the genius of the Buddha's teaching, I think. He's taking a thing we don't want and using it for liberation. A new and non-objective outlook may then progressively prevail on us, and we may come to understand that we are not the ego. We may then, with a complete and new awareness, taste the unexpected flavor of those moments of non-desire, which will be revealed as being plenitude, silence, and peace. This flavor, which is only fleeting at first, will become more constant and vigorous until that time when it will appear as a reality which carries us, enfolds us, and is our very substance. Non-desire, okay? That's a word I like to use too. In when I sit down, I say non-desire as an attitude. So that if I'm trying to get something, non-desire feels like this. The bliss which is then experienced is entirely different from what we usually call happiness. For at this level of consciousness, one cannot even say I am happy, since a consciousness which establishes a distinction between a subject and an attribute would be a dual consciousness. We are now speaking of the deep peace of Nibbana. We have mentioned watchfulness and availability. So this teacher, John Klein, he uses, I like these two words also, watchfulness and availability. I don't know how you say that in Thai, but consider that's a spiritual practice that you can remember to do. It's not something that you need to get tomorrow. You need to remember to do it now. And watchful, that's not so complicated. Just observant and available, not caught up with any object of experience, watchful and available. We have mentioned watchfulness and availability. It must be understood that these must be perfect in their quality. The quality and the purity of attention, which result, are the conditions, are the essential conditions of success. Again, we have mentioned watchfulness and availability, it must be understood that these must be perfect in their quality. The quality and the purity of attention, which result, are the essential conditions of success. So what I'm suggesting to you, like when I say practice awake consciousness for one in-breath. So like you're trying to practice this balance of watchfulness and availability for one in-breath. You know, like riding a bicycle. You know, you have to have balance, and you ride the bicycle in balance. So you're riding the in-breath in the sense of watchful, available. So you're cultivating the quality of attention rather than just trying to hold your mind on the object. And as the quality of attention wavers, you observe why that is, and you get better and better at it. So it's not a becoming, it's a doing, it's a being. The exercise of this pure attention implies the complete elimination of all elements from the past, thus allowing the authentic purity of the present to be completely grasped. And that's very, very hard to stay in the present moment, isn't it? You know, I get the memory of the email that the person sent me. That memory comes, that's the past, but it grabs attention. And I get caught up in regret or resentment, and the sense of self is born. So to not be caught by memory elements of the past and project into the future is a big part of the meditative exercise, present moment awareness. It's, you know, we all know that it's a considerable human achievement to stay in the present moment with the ordinary. It's easy to stay in the present moment when there's danger or fear or excitement. Those naturally stimulate us to stay in the present moment. But to stay in the present moment with a walking path, which is so boringly ordinary, is actually quite an achievement. So that's one of the intentions we need to make in our meditative life, is present moment awareness. You just make that intention constantly, present moment awareness, present moment awareness. You keep reminding yourself of that. And you get better at it. You get better and better at it. So it's this lovely gradual training. So the exercise of this pure attention implies the complete elimination of all elements from the past, thus allowing authentic purity of the present to be completely grasped. We must forget everything and wait, yet wait for nothing. That's an interesting phrase. We must forget everything and wait, yet wait for nothing. This entails a state of complete receptivity. So that's another word I like. Obviously, this teacher has really influenced me. But, you know, like it's an interesting word, receptivity, as opposed to grasping. So when I ask you, listen to sound, I'm asking you, be receptive to sound. I'm not asking you to listen to a particular sound. Doesn't matter. Or when I say, make conscious the feelings in your shoulders, that's a receptive. And that's why listening is a good word, a good synonym for awareness. Because there's something about listening for me, I don't know about you, it's a very receptive attitude. Looking for me, so often I'm looking, oh, which bird is that, and how much snow is there this morning? Huh? Not that the ears can't do that, but listening, I think, is a good synonym for awareness, receptive. And these are the qualities of attention that we are cultivating. Huh? Receptive, present, non-becoming, all that language begins to make a lot of sense, and you train with that kind of language. This entails a state of complete receptivity, which seizes and is open to the complete, eternal, and perfect newness of each moment. So this final paragraph, it is also important that the body should be in a state of perfect relaxation. as the slightest attraction or repulsion results in tensions which impede the purity of attention. That's difficult in meditation. That's why I think developing yoga nidra, you know, developing the lying posture, if you're successful at it, then a lot of the holding of the body, which you don't notice as a me trying to hold the body, can be eliminated. Now, yes, people do fall asleep, and it's a difficult posture maybe to stay conscious in, but if you can develop it and work on that, then you can get a sense of deep body relaxation and bright awareness. And then there is no struggle with the body, and the sense of receptivity becomes stronger. So I would really encourage, and I think a lot of you do try it, but I'd encourage you to develop that lying posture seriously, not just as a Viradhamma joke that an old monk does, but actually as a serious posture, because I find it incredibly. Like I do lying meditation for 2 hours in the morning, and it's incredibly interesting. The day hasn't started, the ego thoughts haven't churned up, and coming out of deep sleep, it's a very, very interesting posture. So, and then in sitting or walking, you have to deal with discomforts and pains. So then you use the Four Noble Truths. That there is a pain, and there's the craving not to have the pain, which is biological. So you realize if you just shift on every discomfort, you'll be restless. So then you're letting go of tanha around physical discomfort. But finding your own balance, finding your own body and not hurting the body, and yet being able to oton, to bear witness to pain, because that's an important lesson too. So that, I mean, it's the Four Noble Truths, then you get different. I think, you know, it's not just Buddhism that talks about this. And like I find readings which are approximate to the Buddhist teaching, I find very, very refreshing, because, you know, like the word like availability, when I first came upon that, well, that's interesting. That's a really clever way to think about it. And language, you know, I'm sure you have that with your Thai ajahns, right? You have so many good ajahns in Thailand. Like Lompa Cha was brilliant with language. I mean, I didn't really understand the Isan accent or Thai, but enough that I could get his energy. But Ajahn Jayasaro, when he explains to me, Lompa Cha's genius in language, and in simile and in anecdote and all that, it's really rather wonderful. So when you listen to a teacher like Lompo Cha, or you know, whatever teachers you have in Thai, and you pick up a word which, that's a good way to think about it, then use that word, because when you hear a word from a teacher that clicks for you, makes sense for you, then that's an insight. You understood something from that word. So then you can bring that word into your practice as sammasankappa, as right thought, pop it into the mind. So when I pop the word receptivity, availability, that takes me to non-desire. When I read about attainment, that takes me to desire. So I don't read about attainment. That doesn't help me, because then I always feel inadequate. So again, if you can get your own language to bring yourself to non-desire, non-becoming, non-resistance, all that kind of language. So if you take these Four Noble Truths, not as an academic exercise, but you bring them up into mind, then they will be the background of your intelligence. There'll be the background of your spiritual intelligence, which will be informing you of how to look at the problem of suffering, right? And that's why we repeat these teachings again and again and again and again, It's not that we're stupid, we understand it, but sometimes we forget how to constantly implement that perspective of dukkha and the letting go of tanha into our lives. Huh? And so this is just a particular way to look at that. All right, I think that's a lot there, a lot to think about. Okay, let's see. To be honest, I find it difficult speaking beyond 45 minutes. That seems to me my span of, and anyway, too much information and you get overloaded, don't you? There's a lot to contemplate there. So let's see if there's any questions on the chat line. When I opened my curtains this morning, my blinds, I discovered under the bird feeder a salt lick. Do you know what a salt lick is? Huh? No. A salt lick is a block of salt, about so big, that Venerable Vipassi organized for me. And cows, you know, farmers put salt licks out in the fields for the cows to lick because animals are seeking salt. So he organized one of the laymen to get me a salt lick, which is now under my bird feeder. And now we're waiting for the deer to come to lick the salt. Anyway, it was a nice surprise. No one's coming. Also, do you know what a porcupine is? Porcupine, men, what in Thai? Men. Okay, so we have porcupines here. And that usually you see them in the trees in the winter. And we have one that's been feeding on the grass. So we think he's afraid of heights. So we're a bit worried about him. And now there's all this snow and he's been hanging around here feeding on the grass like a deer. We say he's confused. So now we're looking up in the internet what to feed a porcupine. It's not the usual pet you have. Anyway, the animal's here. Yeah, we have a question. Okay, so the question is, in trying to awaken to the present moment, what I notice is the background of something like a vibration, a pull rather than a gap between thoughts. Yeah, that's Lompa Samedo calls, again, the question, maybe if you put it up so everyone hears it. Yeah, in trying to awaken to the present moment, what I notice is the background of something like a vibration, a pull rather than a gap between thoughts. If Lompa could kindly perhaps comment on that. So this is something that Lompa Samedo taught a lot over his years as a monk, and he called it the sound of silence. Now when when you're not engaged with objective experience, you know, when you're not like thinking or trying to do something or looking at something, when your mind has that receptive quality, when your mind is available, as it were, huh? And it sits in that posture of availability, then you begin to sense this kind of vibration, this kind of energy. And that's a very good thing to relax into. It's not really like a normal sound that you're listening to. It's something like space, really. Like space isn't something that you normally attend to. Like if I'm in this room, I see the books, I see the floor, I see the color of the walls. So usually my attention is on the objective experience, the people, but there is space. And then that space is something that I only notice if I make the intention to notice it. So if I look at, if I'm in this room, this is has a high ceiling, very spacious. And then outside, there's a lot of space. And I tune into that space. The objects are still there, but the space is something that really relaxes. It doesn't grab my attention because there's no object there. So in the same way, the sound of silence, when your mind relaxes and just knows the way things are, you start to sense that. And that's a good sign. It's a good sign that you're not grasping objects, that your mind is opening and relaxing to the way things are. So it's not an attainment. Be careful. Oh, I have the sound of silence, because that'll mess your mind up. But actually, I would think it's a sign of good practice, and that you can maybe refer to and relax into. Now, some people find that sound can be so powerful that it's annoying. And then finally, some people ask, is that sound tinnitus or tinnitus? Do you know what tinnitus is or tinnitus? Do you have that, you know, when people have a problem with their hearing and they get this very high-pitched sound? Do you have that word in Thai? Yeah, you know that. Okay, so some people ask, is the sound of silence that? Well, I don't know. But certainly for me, it's very relaxing. It's like the person in the question says, it's a pull. Yeah, it has a kind of pull to it, but not in a bad way. So I use it as a sign of the mind being in a good space, being in the right space. So I would encourage the person to explore that. That's quite good. So also for you, and so Lompo Sumedho for many years, he doesn't do it now so much. He now just teaches consciousness, right? But he used for many years to refer to the sound of silence. He'd do that for many, many years. And his own experience of that was, I think he noticed that as a Samana era, forgot about it. And then in London, as he was walking along a busy street, that sound came very strongly into consciousness. And he began to use that all the time, even within situations which were very noisy or very busy. He turned his mind to that, and that's how he practiced for many, many years. So if he was on the subway, he'd relax into the sound of silence. If he was at the dentist, he'd relax into the sound of silence. If he was at a boring committee meeting, he would relax into the sound of silence. So if that is something that you're noticing, good, but be careful not to then start to think, well, I have to notice the sound of silence, because that's tanha, right? So any suggestions like these, forget about them. Because you don't want to stimulate tanha. This is always the difficulty with any experiential suggestion, is then we start to look for it, and then we're caught in tanha, and we don't have the purity of the present. We have the affliction of the past telling us where we need to go and what we need to do. And that's always a problem, when you have the past memory of a good experience and you're trying to get it into the future. This happens in interviews sometimes. There'll be four people in interview, three people are having problems, usual maybe dullness or doubt, and one person is blissed out. And the other three people, oh, I want some bliss. I don't want this boredom. And they start to try to get what the other person experienced, which is a disaster. It doesn't really work. So keep to the present moment, but if you do notice that, then relax into it, I'd say. Any more? No, that's it. Alaina?
May I request for your explanation on spaciousness of awareness?
Okay. Yeah, right. So if like I'm looking, you know, we have that stone Buddha in the corner of the bhikkhu, yeah, and in the front window there. Okay, so I'm looking at that, right? And then I can focus on that, and I can see what is the shape of the nose, and what are the shape of the lips, and what's the mudra, what's the hand mudra. So then I'm really paying attention to an object, okay? And then I can take my attention away from the object and it's still there and I kind of know it in my periphery, but I can also get a sense that that object exists in the space of this room. So my, you know, not looking at it now, I'm relaxing the visual focus and then I'm just getting, oh, okay, there's all this space in this room. What is that? What does space feel like? And that's very nebulous, but it does have a feeling to it. It has a feeling because it's not, I'm not attached to an object. I'm opening the mind to a sense, oh, there's this whole space here. So my consciousness now is more involved with the space of the room rather than the object called the Buddha Rupa. So I'm retracting. And in the same way, I can do that with sound. I can hear sound. Let's say maybe there was a construction worker here. There isn't now, but and maybe he had a radio on. And maybe the radio played a Bob Dylan song. And I used to listen to Bob Dylan. And then that would really draw my attention, right? And then my attention would be on the sound. And then it would be very pleasant. But then I said, no, come away from the sound. The sound is still there. What is the space that the sound is taking place in? And that would relax my mind. And the sound would still be there, but my attention would be more on space. And then I would start to equate awareness with space rather than concentration on an object. And to me, that's important. I can concentrate on an object, yes, and that's important. But also, perhaps more difficult, is I can attend to the spaciousness of awareness by not being taken by objects, right? By not, so the object would be, let's say, I'm sitting here and someone starts to use a chainsaw. So the object of attention, the object of sound grabs my attention because I want a peaceful room. I don't want noise and irritation arises. But then I say, well, that irritation is an object in awareness. I let go of that relationship to the sound and then the annoyance in the sound starts to fall away because I'm taking perspective from space rather than the object. And awareness as space is a very important concept. I know it's vague or nebulous, but it's very important to get that because then you can see that the whole identity with body, I am the body, is not true. And that's why I do that exercise. Notice the body, like the last meditation for you this morning, I think, was on body, yeah? Body meditation. I said, notice the head in awareness. Notice the eyes in awareness. And that's what I'm trying to convey is a sense of space. Notice the body in awareness. So then there is the space of knowing and the bodily feelings are vibrating or whatever. And you see, yeah, there is awareness and it's not in the body. It's not in the head, but that the head and the body are in awareness. It's a very radical way of looking at things. So it's something you kind of experiment with. Obviously here at in Tisano, you've been here at nights, right? The beautiful nights that we have in the winter with the stars and the space or the light in the daytime. That's a very good exercise. Or the lake where you just open your mind to the space that the lake presents rather than the boats on the lake or the pine trees on the lake, all of that. And that's a kind of exercise, just do deliberately, like at night in the center you're at now, just look at the night sky, even if it's cloudy, get a sense of this whole situation is in awareness, get awareness related to space, experiment in that way. But I find the two methods for indicating awareness as space or conscious space or whatever. Language is very difficult here. The two exercises which I always talk about is taking two sense objects, sound, body. As, you know, normally you think I am here and the sound is out there, which is true on a relative level because the ear faculty is here, the sound's out there. But what I don't notice is that both the experience of sound and the experience of body are both in awareness. They're exactly the same in that sense. And when you play with that exercise, you go between the two, yeah, your intuition begins to see, yeah, it's actually, they're both just objects, even though it seems to be my body and so on. But actually, is there any difference between the bodily feeling and the sound, other than their sense door, right? But is there any difference in terms of object? No, actually, they're both objects. And then that kind of informs your intuitions about awareness, that awareness is not the body. Huh? So that's one way I do. I go between two sense doors, especially sound. So something like, you know, here you can hear the train, right, in the distance, sometimes going through Perth. Okay, so you're sitting here and there is the sound of there is distance. You know, there is locality, there is spatiality, but even that is in awareness. So on one hand, yeah, you can say, I'm here and the train is out there. True. But on the other hand, you can say that very feeling of me and train and distance and space is in awareness. That can be known, right? So you get to see that the sense of self is an object conditioned by in this case, sound and distance. And as you do that more and more, your attachment to mind-body experience gets less because you're identifying more with the space of awareness rather than the objects. So that's one way you go between two sense objects. Then the other way I do it is by noticing change. So I listen to sound and I'll say to you, listen to sound, feel the body, listen to sound, feel the body. What is changing? And what is unchanging? So especially like something like the train, right? Now I listen to the train and you know, it's in the distance. I even know the train driver, that's Boone. and so I hear the sound and then as I listen to it, it's changing. And then I ask myself, what's unchanging? Puru, the knowing. Then I go to the body. Then I go to the body and then I just feel maybe, I just feel my hands, something simple. And it's more subtle, but it's changing, you know, it's temperature, pressure. What's unchanging? And I notice actually it's the same puru, it's the same awareness. And then I move between the two. I listen to sound, that's changing, what's unchanging. Feel the body. Changing, what's unchanging. And I see that between those two sense experiences, there's something constant. So that the constancy in the space, then what do? They it's almost like I'm informing myself about something that is not so obvious. I'm noticing something that's not so obvious. Now, tanha won't do that because tanha is always looking for some experience, right? So try those two suggestions in a very experiment, like it's a little laboratory, and then see how it affects your practice rather than trying to get, you know, some kind of experience. But the perception of space is very, very, very important and helpful. You know, one of the things that Lompo really likes about Amaravati is that it's on the top of a small hill and he loves the space. He loves the sky. And he's always been interested in that aspect of meditation. In Buddhism, we call it akasa meditation. And who's really good at it are the Tibetans. They live in the mountains. They have all these fabulous skies that they have, right? If you're living in a jungle, maybe it's more difficult perception. I don't know. But it's more than just geographical, right? It's about consciousness itself. Is that helpful? Yeah? Okay. Good question. That's an important question. Yeah. Okay. Any others from you in the room, or shall we call it a day? You're probably tired, huh? Okay.